How did Jeff Bezos realize you could sell anything on the internet? Why did Bill Gates create Control-Alt-Delete? How did synchronized swimming prepare Christine Lagarde for international politics? What made Bob Iger bet big on Marvel? And what inspired Diane von Furstenberg to create the wrap dress? On the David Rubenstein Show, Peer-to-Peer Conversations, I uncover the untold stories of the world's most successful leaders. Listen now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to For the Ages, a history podcast presented by the New York Historical Society and hosted by David Rubenstein. Join us as he deftly explores the rich and complex history of the United States with some of the nation's foremost historians and creative thinkers. Because history matters.
Hello, I'm David Rubenstein. I'm going to be in conversation today with Talmadge Boston, who is a lawyer in Dallas, but also a historian who has written a number of very interesting books about American history, among other things. His latest book is How the Best Did It, Leadership Lessons from Our Top Presidents. Thank you very much, Talmadge, for joining us.
It's a great privilege to be with you, David.
If I am correct, is the premise of your book that if one looks at our most successful presidents, and you've picked eight of them, four of them are on Mount Rushmore and four who served subsequently, we can learn a good deal about leadership by examining the distinctive leadership traits exhibited in their presidencies. And the further premise, I presume, is that future presidents would do well to observe the leadership skills of those eight presidents. And do you think that the presidential candidates in the future are actually going to study the past presidents for the leadership skills?
Well, I think you are correct about what my book tries to do. My target audience is anybody who is or aspires to be a leader in any organization for any field of human endeavor, with the idea that the leadership traits that were performed by our greatest presidents are readily transferable to anybody who studies them and aspires to be or is in a position of leadership. So to drive home that point, at the end of each of my eight chapters, I have what I call a mini workbook of questions about the leadership traits of the presidents you just read about in that chapter for the reader to ask him or herself, how am I doing in building consensus, in unifying, in exercising patience when necessary, playing hardball when necessary? So it really attempts to be an interactive experience for the reader who's trying to up his or her game in leadership.
Okay, so let's go through each of the eight presidents. George Washington is our first president, the first person in your book. What distinctive leadership quality did he exhibit? Do you think he was a great leader as a military general or as a great leader as a president? And how do you view the fact that he was a large slave owner during his lifetime? Does that color your views on his leadership skills?
Well, let's take that one at a time. Number one, he learned from his mistakes. He was not a successful soldier or leader during the French and Indian War, but he was smart enough to realize what he had done wrong, and that corrected him and his leadership during the Revolutionary War and afterwards. Even though he was not a great public speaker, he understood the power of nonverbal communications, that often less is more. And so I talk about those traits in the book. He also had a greater self-awareness. He knew his strengths. He knew his weaknesses. And where he was weak, he would glom on to James Madison or Alexander Hamilton to up his game. So those are among the leading traits that Washington had. In terms of him as a military leader versus a political leader, he was A-plus in both. He was unanimously selected to lead our army during the Revolutionary War. He was unanimously selected to lead the Constitutional Convention, and then unanimously selected for both his first and his second term as president. So wherever he went, whatever he did, people were always in agreement that he was the best possible leader and very effective to keep our ragtag army together during the Revolution without the troops being paid in the incredibly difficult and challenging times. Soldiers didn't have shoes, inadequate clothing, freezing winters, and keeping it all together was incredible. And then getting our government off to a great start as our first president amidst all the faction and partisanship that arose was a great achievement. In terms of his being a slave owner, by reason of being a plantation owner in the South, you did what you could to try to make your plantation work. There was not an outside source of labor to speak of in terms of immigration. And so obviously, if you got a large plantation, it takes a lot of people to work it. And unfortunately, the only real option to be able to have the workforce to make a plantation work was slavery. And this bothered Washington, particularly after the Revolution, when he saw African-American soldiers who had performed with such gallantry. And it came to a head right before he died, when he changed his wills and freed the slaves that he owned.
And he was the only founding father to do that, as I recall. Is that right?
Yes.
So let's go through each of the things that Thomas Jefferson did as president that you think deserves special note. Thomas Jefferson probably would say, if maybe you would agree with this, that he wasn't as great a president as he was, let's say, a writer. He wrote the Declaration of Independence at 33 years of age. And in his epitaph that he wrote himself, he put that on the epitaph as well as some other things, but never mentioned his presidency as something he felt should be on his tombstone. So do you think he actually exhibited great leadership skills as president? And what do you think is the great leadership skill that he actually showed as president that is worth other people knowing about?
Well, I think that he had three great leadership traits that he demonstrated during his presidency. Number one, coming off the Adams presidency and the passage of the Sedition Act, which made it a crime punishable by incarceration for someone to criticize Adams or any Federalist policies, Jefferson knew this new country is on thin ice and somebody's got to try to bring it together. So from his first inaugural address, where he said, "We're all Federalists, we're all Republicans, we've got to come together, we've got to work together," he was a master relationship builder with people across the aisle. And he had a steady stream of dinner parties and social engagements to build relationships with the people who he knew didn't necessarily agree with him on political issues. And because he was so personally charming, they became friends. There's the old saying, David, I'm sure you've heard, that if you like somebody, you'll give them the benefit of the doubt. And if you don't, you won't. And so Jefferson made it a point to be as likable to as many different types of people as he could. That's an incredibly valuable trait in any generation. We could use it now with today's polarization. Secondly, because he was so incredibly brilliant, incredibly well-read, long-term vision, amazing imagination, and being able to bounce his ideas off of those who he knew disagreed with him, caused him to have long-term vision that was ultimately top-notch. And then last but not least, which leads to arguably his greatest achievement as president, he was a principled pragmatist. Yes, he had principles, but he also knew certain things needed to get done. And one of those things that needed to get done was the Louisiana Purchase, which really was the great triumph of his second term. It was a deal that he could not let go by at the price to double the size of the country. And even though originally he thought the way he handled it might have been contrary to his prior views on the Constitution, he wouldn't let that stand in the way of achieving this incredible result with the Louisiana Purchase. So I think in order to make government work, you've got to be a principled pragmatist. And so I think Jefferson showed the way in that trait.
So speaking of his brilliance, you remember the famous line that John Kennedy gave at a Nobel Prize winning dinner at the White House?
Yes.
What was that line?
Well, he said this is the greatest collection of genius in the White House since Thomas Jefferson dined alone. And that was very well received. And Jefferson's genius could speak at least seven languages, played the violin, incredibly well read. Great brainstormer, great writer, as you point out, obviously the Declaration of Independence. And most of his presidency was done by correspondence. He, like George Washington, knew he was not a great public speaker. He gave almost no speeches during his eight-year presidency except his inaugural addresses. So his correspondence and his writing was really the record of his presidency, given that he really didn't speak much.
During his initial inauguration, he just walked from his boarding house to the inaugural site and didn't actually have anybody walking with him or having elaborate carriages and so forth. Very simple man in some respects. So let's go on to Abraham Lincoln. I think everybody would agree that he was an incredible leader in winning the Civil War and ultimately freeing the slaves for the Emancipation Proclamation and the 13th Amendment and holding the country together during the Civil War. But is there one or two leadership traits that you most admire Lincoln for?
Well, we could go on forever about his many traits. In fact, of the 24 traits covered by these eight presidents, I think you could make an argument that Lincoln had all 24, and I don't think you could say that about any other president. But the one that to me stands out in the context of dealing with the Civil War and the splitting of the country was his magnanimity, his capacity to have greatness of spirit, which is where we get the word from the Latin, his willingness to forgive, his willingness not to be resentful, his level-headedness throughout the war and directed in so many ways toward his cabinet, Doris Kearns Goodwin's famous team of rivals. These were people, particularly people like Salmon Chase, who were not necessarily his friends, who were not necessarily trying to help him. And yet he kept finding ways to keep the communication open, benefiting from their input, but also with his Union generals, famously the problems he had with McClellan, the problems he had with Meade, the problems he had with Henry Halleck, until finally at last he got a general who he could communicate with and would work as he wanted the war to be conducted, like Grant, but also toward the Union soldiers, his sense of willingness to pardon them when they had deserted, his willingness to try to hold their families together after the war. Also toward the Confederacy, his plans for reconciliation once the war came to an end that John Avalon set out in his wonderful new book of a year and a half ago, Lincoln and the Fight for Peace. And last and certainly not least, his relationship with his wife. Mary was an incredibly difficult woman who made his life in many ways miserable. And yet he always stayed above the fray. He was always generous in spirit toward her. You know, they lost a child before they got to the White House. They lost one in the White House. She was in deep grief. And yet nothing she did caused him to treat her badly or to prevent him from being able to do his job at the highest level as president.
Okay. So of the Mount Rushmore Four, if I can call them that, the final one is Teddy Roosevelt. He seemed to relish being a leader, being visibly in control, and taking unpopular positions. Is there one leadership trait or are there several leadership traits you most admire in Teddy Roosevelt?
Well, the thing that stands out for me in Teddy Roosevelt, I had three traits. Number one, he was a man who never stopped learning. He's probably the most voracious reader we've ever had as president of the United States. His capacity to read book after book after book while he's president of the United States is it's just amazing to even think about it. And he was one of those people like Lincoln, everything he ever read, he remembered. Secondly, he was open to expanding the presidency in ways that he thought it needed to go, whether it be conservation, whether it needed to be in solving a labor strike. He realized he had a bully pulpit, but it would only become as powerful as it could be if he used it. And so he was open to trying things that needed addressing that nobody else seemed to be addressing, and to use his presidential powers for that. But the third and the most important trait, which in answer to your question, which was the most important, I think, was his gift as a mediator. He was not a particularly great public speaker. He was a very energetic public speaker. But as a mediator, Doris Kearns Goodwin properly describes, he had these unusual powers of concentration, his rich cadre of ideas, his ruthless single-mindedness, together with his warmth, unabashed intensity, and pluck of personality, he brought all this to bear to get people to find common ground and resolve their differences. And he did that with the coal strike of 1902, the Russo-Japanese War of 1905, for which he won the Nobel Peace Prize, the Moroccan crisis of 1906, and the second Hague Conference of 1907. So people don't realize how good he was at achieving resolution when people were at war with each other.
He also had many children at the White House while he was president. And to get rid of the time that they often took up from him, he actually built the West Wing, as I remember it, so he could have a place to work without the children running around. But you can tell me whether this is apocryphal or not. Someone once said to him, you know, your daughter is really out of control. Can't you control her? And he said something like, look, I can either run the country or I can control Alice, but I can't possibly do both. Is that a fair statement of what he once said?
Yes, it is.
Okay. So let's now go to the four who came too late for Mount Rushmore. First is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Before becoming president, he contracted polio And some have written that this gave him greater resolve and determination, which ultimately made him a stronger and more decisive leader. Do you agree with that? And is that the distinctive leadership trait he brought to and exhibited throughout his presidency?
Well, I certainly agree with that. His overcoming polio and defying polio and getting on with this amazingly productive and dynamic life despite polio is one of the great stories in American history. And obviously, whenever you can overcome adversity like that, you come out stronger. It makes you stronger, both as a person, as a leader. So that is a big part of trying to understand why Franklin Roosevelt is regarded by just about everyone as our third greatest president behind Lincoln and Washington. But in terms of the other traits that Roosevelt had that made him stand out as a leader and that I think are worthy of emulation, he was just such a great communicator. And he knew when to speak with vigor, like in his inaugural address or like his remarks after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, when there was that staccato, powerful, dynamic, forceful voice that inspired people in the Great Depression, inspired people to face the prospect of entering World War II. But there was also the conversational style he had that he used throughout his fireside chats and that could calm Americans down about the Depression, about his closing the banks, about what was going on in Europe. And here we had a country that coming out of World War I wanted to stay isolationist for the most part. And yet with each passing month, it became clear we can't ignore Hitler. Bad things are going to happen. Winston Churchill and Europe are not going to be able to defeat him. We're going to have to enter this, and this is the only way we can defeat this crazy person. So an incredible communicator, and not only did he communicate well, but he actually persuaded, and this is evidence in large part by how he got the country ready to leave the isolationist thoughts behind and get ready to fight a war by moving one step at a time through public sentiment with fireside chats, with speeches, and never going too far that he would outrun his audience, but he brought them along step by step to where when the time came after Pearl Harbor that we needed to enter World War II in order to defeat Hitler and the Japanese, America was ready.
So you greatly admire Franklin Delano Roosevelt, obviously. Another president that you admire and you've put in your book is Dwight Eisenhower. Now, he was considered a great general. He led the Allied victory in D-Day and the victory in Europe. But at the time that he served as president, and I would say maybe for 10 or 15 years afterwards, he was seen as a weak and indecisive president compared to the strong and decisive general he had been. But in recent years, it seems scholars have said he was actually a very good and decisive president. He kept the peace, presided over prosperity. I assume the latter view of Eisenhower's is yours, but what are the leadership traits as president that he brought to the presidency that you most admire?
Well, believing in the greatness of his presidency is not only my opinion, but as you know, David, every time there's a changing of the guard in the White House, we have a new president enter, the 150 leading historians in America respond to the C-SPAN presidential ranking poll, where they evaluate each president from best to worst in like 10 different categories of what it takes to be a great president. And in the last two, in 2017 and 2021, in the C-SPAN ranking polls, in both of those, Eisenhower is ranked fifth behind Lincoln, Washington, and both Roosevelts. So why it took so long for people to begin to appreciate what a great president he was because he was not a great public communicator as president. And obviously, he did play a fair amount of golf. And when Kennedy ran in 1960, particularly coming off of Sputnik, there was this perception that he was too old and he was slow thinking and that other people were running the government. And we had to wait a few years before his presidential papers were released for scholars to review when everybody realized, no, he was in the big middle of everything. He was the decider. He was the one responsible for 8 years of peace and prosperity. And so with that awareness of his incredible success, we look back now in 2024, say to ourselves, wouldn't it be wonderful if we had a president who could give us peace and prosperity? That's quite an achievement for a president. So in terms of the traits that caused him to be so successful, per his military leadership of the Allied forces, he built this incredibly complex and effective organization under the executive branch of the government, with his cabinet, with the National Security Council, with his Office of Congressional Liaison. He also was extremely good at displaying patience when needed. Remember, when he became president, Joseph McCarthy was at the height of his powers. Well, everybody's saying, Ike, you got to get in McCarthy's face and deal with this son of a gun harshly, effectively. And Eisenhower said, no, I'll give him enough rope to hang himself. And he did. And in time, sure enough, that's what happened. So he had the ability to exercise patience in order to achieve the best possible result. And then finally, his ability to play hardball when necessary, which again, tied to his military leadership. But looking at how he dealt with the Suez Crisis in 1956 and shutting the door on England and Israel and France unless they abided by his direction, and that was get out of the Suez. That's not our business. It's going to disrupt the balance of power in the Middle East and in the Cold War. And because he played hardball so well, they did what he said.
So at the time that he was president, I was a young boy, and I remember looking at him and thinking he was old, really old. Of course, I was probably 7 or 8 at the time. And then I looked it up to find out what age he actually was. He was elected president when he was 62 years old. I mean, it's like a teenager today. And he left the presidency, he was more or less 69 or 70. So let's talk about his successor, John Kennedy. As president, he was very young. He was elected at the age of 43, and he was seen by many Americans as a youthful leader who energized the American people and was very bold in his decision-making. The greatest example of that, many would say, was his decision about how to resolve the Cuban Missile Crisis, which brought the world closer to nuclear war than at any other time in our history. Do you agree that that was his finest hour of leadership? And what other traits did he exhibit during his relatively short presidency do you really admire?
Well, the Cuban Missile Crisis was his greatest achievement. Early in his presidency, he had had the biggest disaster of his presidency in the way he handled the Bay of Pigs fiasco in Cuba. And the reason he had made bad decisions about that was because all the advice he was getting from the military experts was, oh yeah, we can pull this off. This is going to work. This is how we're going to overthrow Castro. And they were 100% wrong, and it was a total embarrassment. Well, by the time the Cuban Missile Crisis came around in October 1962, he had learned his lesson that people who hold themselves out as experts and who have resumes that suggest that they are experts need to be listened to very carefully and not rubber stamped. And he demonstrated that by the way he handled the Cuban Missile Crisis. The 42 hours of the discussions he had with his executive committee, which included his military leaders, reveal he was in charge. He rejected certain advice from key leaders. He was the quarterback that led to the successful resolution that avoided nuclear war by making the trade that we would withdraw our missiles from Turkey if Russia would withdraw their missiles from Cuba. His strategy of using the naval blockade as opposed to bombing or invading worked. And so that was a great triumph for any president in our history. In terms of his other traits that he demonstrated, he came into the office, he didn't really know much about foreign policy. He didn't know much about monetary policy, but he was brilliant. And he was a quick study, and he surrounded himself with people who really were experts, and he picked up on it incredibly quickly. He also was a quick study in terms of civil rights. He came into office thinking civil rights was a political issue, but as the movement came on, and particularly in Birmingham and fire hoses being blasted at children and all that was going on, he realized it was not a political issue, it was a moral issue. And that's why he gave his great television address on civil rights, which led to the submission of the Civil Rights Bill to Congress, which unfortunately he couldn't get through before he was killed. But thankfully, Lyndon Johnson did get through.
So interestingly, when the Cuban Missile Crisis, I have a memory of that as a child because I was in the 7th grade, I think, or 8th grade. And my teacher said, I'm not going to give you any homework because I don't think we'll be here tomorrow. That was kind of scary for a young person, but okay. I also remember distinctly practicing these drills because if a nuclear weapon were to come and explode over us when I was growing up in Baltimore, we were supposed to get under a desk as if a desk would protect you from radiation somehow. I never understood that. Final point I would make, something you referred to that's always of interest to me. John Kennedy on the Cuban Missile Crisis, it was a tour de force because clearly people thought, as my teacher did, that we were going to have nuclear bombs exploding over the United States. But he cut a deal, as you referred to it, with the Russians, where we would ultimately remove our Jupiter missiles from Turkey. But it was supposed to be a secret. And John Kennedy didn't want it to be known before the election that he had done this for a lot of political reasons. But you think about it, he was trusting the Russians to not leak the fact that he cut a secret deal, and the Americans didn't know it, but the Russians did. It'd be complicated to think you could hold that secret today. Is that right?
That is right. In fact, one of the people who didn't know about that secret deal was his vice president, Lyndon Johnson. And Johnson thought that it was Kennedy's presence and ego and brilliance that had caused the Cuban Missile Crisis to end favorably, when in fact it ended because of the trade that you just mentioned. And so a lot of people, reliable historians, think Johnson was so emboldened to escalate in Vietnam because he thought, man, if we're bold and we're strong and we talk tough and so forth, we'll get the result we want, because he thought that had been the tough talk that had caused Kennedy to be successful in ending the Cuban Missile Crisis. So it was a well-kept secret, and I agree with you. I don't think those kind of secrets could be kept today.
So finally, of the eight presidents, we have Ronald Reagan. He confronted the Soviet Union in a very bold way, such as his advocating for a Star Wars type of military capability that the Soviets could not afford to compete with, and ultimately that probably helped to end the Soviet Union. In doing this or other actions that Ronald Reagan took, what are the leadership skills or traits of Ronald Reagan that you most admire?
Well, my research reminded me that the biggest part of Reagan's greatness as a president was his capacity not only to be optimistic himself, but to inspire optimism across the country. Jimmy Carter's presidency in many ways was a disaster, and America was demoralized. The economy was bad. He couldn't rescue the hostages in the Middle East. He spoke as if nothing good was going to happen. He blamed others. And along came Reagan, who said, no, we can be the shining city on the hill. We can restore America's greatness. We just got to have a belief that we can do it. And then he succeeded. People believed him. He, as you know, defeated Carter in a blowout. He then defeated Carter's vice president, Mondale, 4 years later in a second blowout. And so I don't think anybody ever succeeds in leadership if you're a pessimist. I think you have to have a spirit of looking ahead with hope and the capacity that things can be done. And Reagan was a master at that. But also, besides the optimism, was just this long-term vision that, beginning with his first political speech in 1964, in the height of the Cold War, not long after the Cuban Missile Crisis, where he's speaking on behalf of Barry Goldwater, he's saying, we can defeat communism. We can win the Cold War. We can bring the Soviet Union down. And people didn't believe him. They thought that was naive. And yet, because of the way he handled his presidency, as you mentioned, with Star Wars that ultimately drove the Soviet Union to its economic knees, he got them to finally tear down that wall and end the Cold War. So this long-term vision coupled with optimism was what made him, quote, the great communicator and such a successful president on so many fronts.
So your book ends with presidents who served in the 20th century. Do you have any presidents who served in the 21st century who have a leadership trait that you might admire, or are you saving that for a future book?
Well, in terms of our 21st century presidents, I'll take them one by one. George W. Bush, I think he's being recognized for his moral leadership through his PEPFAR program that has saved millions of lives in Africa from the HIV virus. So to be a president who sees a responsibility to be a moral leader around the world is certainly a trait worthy of emulation. President Obama, throughout his 8 years, no matter what was happening, he projected a calmness. He spoke, obviously, with an eloquence. And so those are admirable traits. President Trump, the only thing I can think of positive is from time to time, he did show that he knows how to play hardball, although he doesn't play it nearly as well as Eisenhower did. And President Biden, he has made an effort, certainly, to cross the aisle, build rapport and relationships with Republicans without a whole lot of success. and certainly not on the level of success that Thomas Jefferson or Lincoln or FDR had. But he's definitely at least tried to develop some sort of consensus at a time of great difficulty, David, as you know as well as I do, because of the way the media now operates and the way the extreme right and the extreme left now control our political parties.
So I very much enjoyed reading your book, Talmadge, and it is the official publication date is when?
April 2nd.
April 2nd. Okay. You avoided April 1st, right?
Yes, I am happy to say on April 1st, I'll be at Politics and Prose in Washington, D.C. Maybe
okay.
You're available. You can come over. Evan Thomas is going to interview me, and we're keeping our fingers crossed that C-SPAN will cover us.
Okay. Well, I would say it's a book that's worthy of C-SPAN covering. I really enjoyed reading it. So we've been in discussion today with Talmadge Boston on his book, How the Best Did It, Leadership Lessons from Our Top Presidents. Talmadge, thank you very much for a conversation. I hope to see you at Politics and Prose, okay?
That's the deal, David, and good luck with the Baltimore Orioles. I know that was something you'd been working on a while. I'm glad you finally could bring it to fruition. I know you'll be a great owner.
Thanks very much. I hope so, but we'll find out. Okay, thanks very much, Talmadge.
On behalf of the New York Historical Society, thank you for joining us for another episode of For the Ages, a History Podcast, hosted by David Rubenstein. We hope you enjoyed it and come back for more. Thanks for your support. You can share your thoughts at public.programs@nyhistory.org.